Green news for you.
Green news for you. Your environmental news source. Bring you the latest in environmental news.
With the weekly roundup.
A WPS production.
And Becky and
Hello, I'm your host, Mel, and I want to welcome you to another edition of Green News for You. We all have a part to play in the ecosystem. Everything we do affects the environment around us, from logging, strip mining, deforestation, water pollution, population expansion, the list goes on. All these things affect the wildlife and in turn affects the population. That's human population and wildlife population. We all know capturing the perfect picture can communicate more than words. So in this episode, I'll be talking with Sebastian about wildlife conservation. Sebastian grew up in Munich, Germany, and moved to the United States when he was 10 years old. His fascination with wildlife began in Europe and only increased once he saw the wilderness that America has to offer. Wildlife became his passion, and he studied behavioral ecology at the University of California at Santa Cruz to further his knowledge about animals. His current mission is to showcase the beauty and intricacies of nature while highlighting the critical need for more conservation efforts through his images. He loves to photograph and experience the animals he sees and wants to share these stories through his images. This, he hopes, will inspire others to help fight for conservation of these amazing creatures. Sebastian, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thanks for having me, man.
You've been photographing for quite some time, and you take amazing photographs from what I've seen from your portfolio. How long exactly have you been photographing wildlife?
I would say about 4 years now. I started in college and I graduated in 07 and I've continued since then.
That's great. But your passion for wildlife has extended way before then, like when you were in Munich, Germany, and your upbringing. What drove you towards deciding to get into photography?
Yeah, like you said, I've always had that passion for wildlife, so I really enjoyed being outside and sharing time with animals, but I was kind of realizing that other people didn't necessarily have the same feelings, and I found that when I did show my pictures to people that they would kind of enjoy the outdoors maybe a little bit more, maybe want to take a hike themselves. So I thought sharing images was a great tool to kind of get people outside and enjoy nature a little bit more.
And from that, you also offer some photography classes, is that correct?
Yeah, so I do one-on-one lessons and workshops here in Santa Cruz or the general Bay Area in California. And that's always really rewarding, too, because you get to meet people one-on-one and you can really see the progress of how they develop photographically.
That's great. And you're in a great location for photography with the bay right there and with the mountain ranges and everything else. You have a plethora of wildlife.
Yeah, Monterey Bay is is a real hot spot. In fact, worldwide, it's one of the most biodiverse regions, which is quite amazing. And so because we're at the coast where the ocean meets land, we have just a huge amount of biodiversity, animals that live both in the ocean and on land. So, yeah, it's a quite amazing place because you just have this huge range of subject matter.
A lot of people specialize in something. Some may specialize in undersea photography. Some do mountain ranges. Where do you find your niche?
My niche is actually not so much in terms of direct subject matter, but more in terms of the conservation aspect of things. Animals that are endangered, animals that have really low population numbers. So it's not necessarily where the animals found, but how many of them are found. So because it is so important for me to show people that there's these beautiful animals out there that are endangered, that need our help, I try to focus on that aspect of it.
Yeah, I find that since our population is growing, we have to grow somewhere, and we tend to expand into where nature used to be. And
exactly. And
in the process, we're destroying some of the ecosystem and some of the habitat where, you know, the habitat that was native to the area. So you find a lot of animals, like here in Maryland, where we've expanded so much that we're having wolves start to come in towards the Beltway area. And, you know, that was unheard of And when I talked to some people around here, I said, wolves, you know. But, yeah, they are in the area, but they're starting to show up more around where habitat is. And bears also. And when you're taking pictures of, do you find that happening a lot?
Yeah, you know, like you said, we are constantly expanding. We're encroaching on native habitat where animals live. So people are surprised when all of a sudden a mountain lion shows up in their backyard. But, I mean, they're living right at the edge of their habitat. So they're surprised, but really they shouldn't be because they're living in the habitat of that animal.
Right. It's almost like we have to find a way to work with our environment instead of destroy our environment,
yes.
Which is, I believe, part of what you're doing. Now, I know you don't like to toot your horn a lot, and I saw that when I was looking at your blogs, but what magazines and media outlets has your work been published?
Well, the great part is that I'm represented by a really great stock photography agency, and so they distribute my images for me. And they have great connections, which, you know, would take me years to build up. So they've licensed images to The Economist, National Geographic Kids, a local magazine here is Bay Nature, that's pretty big in the Bay Area. And then other magazines that are more conservation-oriented, like Defenders of Wildlife, or even there's even Your Big Backyard, which is an affiliate of Ranger Rick. So it's really quite humbling to have your images show up in all these different publications, you know, because when we all start out, that's kind of many of our dreams, and then seeing it, it's a really nice moment to have.
Right, and you're doing something that a lot of people dream about doing, being able to get out in nature and to photograph wild animals and animals that are extinct. What countries have you had the opportunity to visit and photograph wildlife?
You know, like we started talking about at the beginning, since this area is so biodiverse, I've really concentrated most of my efforts here in the Monterey Bay area. One, traveling's a lot cheaper that way.
Right.
And then there are a lot of animals here that are endangered, even animals that many of us here in California at least take for granted, like sea otters, but people don't realize there's only around 3,000 left. So, and they're great because they're cute animals. So when you take pictures, you know, people really kind of latch on to them.
Right.
And you can really use them as a driving force for conservation. But I've also spent a little bit of time in Senegal, in Africa. And then the other place I was, which is still in the country, but people probably don't think of it that way, is Midway Atoll, which is about halfway between California and Japan. It's a 5-hour flight west of the main Hawaiian Islands. And it's a really unique place because there's only 63 people living on the island, but there's 2 million seabirds.
Wow.
So that's an incredible place. I mean, you can't walk 5 feet without having to weave around nesting albatrosses.
Mm-hmm. Now, what type of challenges, let's go ahead and focus on that island that you're talking about. What type of challenges when you're photographing these wild animals? And I guess what I'm trying to say is the environment is affecting these animals.
Yeah, so there's two kind of different aspects that are challenging. One, photographically speaking, you know, because there's so many birds, it's actually kind of hard to focus on something in particular. It's so overwhelming for the first couple of days that you're just surrounded by these birds that it's really hard to make aesthetically pleasing images. And so you kind of have to slow yourself down and focus on one thing at a time to show. And then environmentally, the challenges, you know, they're not so much photographically speaking, but for the birds, they're facing quite a few challenges as well themselves because there's lots of plastic, for example, out on Midway that they eat, and then actually they'll have stomachs full of plastic and they'll die of starvation, even though, again, they have stomachs that are full.
Right, and I've heard about that where a lot of the plastics are being washed out into the Pacific Ocean with that huge garbage patch out there that's larger than
exactly.
The state of Texas. And I've heard about the birds, you know, picking the plastic and taking it back because they don't know it's not a food source. And
yes, exactly.
They feed it to their chicks. And
yes, that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah, and it's actually damaging the population, which is very unfortunate. And a lot of people don't realize that. And that's one of the biggest challenges. We've been so much focused on renewable energy and our carbon footprint, and our waters have almost taken a back seat to those two.
I think that's partially because either we don't ever see ocean, or even if we see ocean, we see, you know, less than 1% of it along the coast. And water is kind of removed from our mental state because we're just not in it constantly, unlike, you know, land. So when you do have, like you said, these floating mounds of garbage in the Pacific, we don't see them, so we're not really concerned about them. But on the on Midway itself, there's 5 tons of plastic that wash ashore there every year.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's quite devastating. But, you know, and that's the other thing, 63 people. You know, there's a difference between 63 people being constantly exposed to it, so that, you know, fairly low number compared to some environmental problem that we face in the Bay Area, where there's 7 million people.
Right.
And so, like you said, it's, you know, just in terms of exposure. But that's exactly what I think how photography can help is, if you take these images that show these conservation issues or environmental issues, then you can present those to a more international audience, an audience that might never make it out to the place you're photographing, but an audience that would be legitimately concerned about that issue.
Right.
So that's the tool photography provides.
And that's great, because a lot of us don't get to see that or experience that. And that's how come photography is so important, even videography. And catching that, and I'm sure that you face this, is trying to get the perfect shot to relay a message. Can you share with me something about trying to get that perfect shot and the challenges you face trying to get a perfect shot?
Sure. Like you said, it's quite challenging, and I think that's what a lot of people maybe respect about wildlife photography and conservation photography, is that, in fact, it does always take a long time till you get the shot you want. So there's different situations that can provide challenges. I mean, or just being uncomfortable. For example, I was photographing California red-legged frogs, which are a threatened species here in California. And I was out with researchers at night, and what you do is you wade into these ponds about a chest deep, which is all fine. I mean, it's very cold, but you can handle it. And then after about photographing for, now, only a couple of minutes, I was thinking to myself, why are my hands burning? And then I finally took my headlamp and I turned it on, and I was looking at my hands, and there were hundreds and hundreds of mosquitoes on my hands.
Oh, Christ.
Yeah, so that's a challenge. And then sometimes you have animals that are extremely shy, that it just takes forever to just get close. There's another threatened species here in California called California clapper rail, which is a chicken-sized marsh bird. It's not really a shorebird, but a marsh bird that lives in tidal marshes here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And they're just extremely good at hiding in this long grass that grows in these marshes. And it literally took me 5 months to get a shot of it, one that was good enough. And that's because I just couldn't ever get close. So it just took months and months of sitting there in this tidal channel at low tide till finally I had a bird that accepted me, to the point of where it ran below my tripod to catch a crab on the other side of me, so close I could have just grabbed it with my hand, but it takes time.
And you're even faced with more challenges because you're photographing endangered species, and I always find it amazing, especially when I watch the Discovery Channel behind the scenes and what the photographers and the videographers have to go through just to get the perfect shot. So I can only imagine the challenges that you face. And I'm not sure. I love the photography. I love the pictures, but I'm not sure I'd want to go through having mosquitoes eat my fingers. You know, that's a little bit too intense for myself. I'm the one that enjoys looking at the photographs. Now, when you're traveling around or in certain areas and you get to interact with some of the local people in the area, and they relay to you some of the changes in the animal behaviors and how, you know, how they see a decline in the population and stuff like that. Can you tell me some of the feedback you get from local people when you're talking to them?
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's kind of one of those perfect examples of when you're a kid and you have you talk to your grandparents and they're saying, when I was young, you have those experiences constantly when you're doing conservation photography where you're talking to local people and they say, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, these creeks were full of steelhead salmon, which is another endangered species here in California, where they would just fish for them with their hands, and now, you know, they're lucky if they see one. So it's actually a pretty hard part of this type of photography because it's a little bit depressing in a way, because all you're ever hearing is populations going down in numbers and it being just way different 30, 40 years ago. So you just have to kind of remind yourself that by taking these pictures, you're trying to revert that process a little bit.
Right. And I can understand the challenges in that. Now you have a project that's coming up in Yemen. Can you tell me more about that project?
Sure. It's focusing on another endangered species, which is the Arabian leopard. It's actually critically endangered just because there's less than 200 Arabian leopards left in all of the world. I mean, they're only concentrated in the Arabian Peninsula, but worldwide there's less than 200 left, which is a very low number. So I'm going to part of the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen, and I will be trying to photograph Arabian leopards there using mostly camera traps.
Wow. Which
is, you know, another specialized form of photography, but these animals are so shy and elusive that, and since they've been hunted, they're just scared of humans, that it's very difficult to get pictures of. In fact, there are maybe one or two pictures that people have ever taken of leopards, and that's seeing one 200 yards away, walking away kind of a thing. So camera traps are really the perfect tool for that, for this assignment.
Right. Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say I'm really excited about it.
I'm excited also because it's interesting. Do you know where the population used to be at and how it declined?
Yeah, so the population used to be all around the Arabian Peninsula, from Israel down to Yemen, down to Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Oman, and it has just dramatically decreased into these isolated pockets. That's mostly because of a few different reasons. One, just habitat destruction, just like, you know, we face here a lot, just road building will cut a lot of the populations off and will bring people in, and they used to be hunted as well. And now part of the problem is that since they're so rare, people hunt them not to kill them but to catch them and have them as pets, so to speak, because it's such a signal of being rich that you own an animal that is so rare you can afford to hunt it, so to speak.
That's surprising, but it, you know, in a way, it's not surprising.
Yeah, it's you know, it's people love rare things, so they don't really care if that means that the population will die out as long as they have one for the time being. You know, they think it makes them look better.
Right, and I can also see how hunting and you know, at one time, fur was really large. And I could see that those Arabian leopards' fur being used in the fur trade, and it wouldn't surprise me if they're still doing it today or trying to do it.
Yeah, and you know, the other problem is that most of the Arabian Peninsula has money due to oil, but Yemen is the one country that is a very poor country in that area because they don't have oil reserves. So, you know, when farmers have livestock and a leopard takes one of those animals, like a goat or a sheep, then it is a much greater loss to one of those farmers than anywhere else, like Saudi Arabia, for example. So they're much more likely to want to retaliate by killing that leopard because it's just much bigger loss to them.
And that brings up another point is food sources. When we start to build out and we begin to build roads and the population dies, not only the population of animals die, but their food source is depleted. Another issue.
Yeah, that's the last, or the last big issue for leopards, is that their prey is just being absolutely depleted, which is kind of this catch-22, because then their next biggest option is livestock, but then they run into trouble with humans again.
Exactly.
Humans were the first people to reduce the prey numbers in the first place. So it's a really challenging problem because you kind of need to convince the local people, but like you said earlier, you need to work with the local people to kind of change the attitude towards leopards and try to figure out solutions where both people and the leopards benefit.
Is there any type of conservation that's going on now to help save the leopards?
There is a little bit, but that's part of kind of the exciting part about it, and maybe potentially you could think of it as a sad part too that hasn't been done earlier, but at least now the problem has been recognized, and the conservation is really kind of starting now. There's captive breeding programs, which is kind of a last resource, but the nonprofit I'll be working with in Yemen, which is the Foundation for the Protection of the Arabian Leopard in Yemen. I know that's a mouthful, but so they're really starting to create major projects and drives for the conservation of Arabian leopards there. And even, this may not sound like a big thing, but recently they convinced the government to make the Arabian leopard the national animal of Yemen. And when we think of bald eagles here in the States, you know, we kind of have that same mentality towards bald eagles. Bald eagles were endangered at one point, but
right.
We really made an effort to bring them back. And I mean, no American is not proud of a bald eagle. So that kind of same mentality and concept is now being deployed in Yemen to try to kind of just change the mental mindset of the Yemeni people about Arabian leopards.
Now, when you go on these trips out of the country, how are they sponsored?
So there's different ways that photography projects are sponsored now in this day and age. National Geographic's the only magazine, at least that I know of, that is still sending out photographers on assignments. The rest is all stock-based, where the images have already been taken. So for this assignment, since I'm not employed by National Geographic, which of course would be great, but I'm not, so I'm funding this actually mostly myself. And it's a lot of money, and I don't swim in money, so I have to save up for it, but it's something I feel really strongly about. So, I'm funding it myself, plus with a little bit of help from the nonprofit that I was just telling you about.
Right, right. Now, how can somebody help donate or contribute to this cause here that you're working towards?
Yeah, one of the biggest problems that Arabian leopard faces is that there's not enough awareness and therefore not enough money going into its conservation. So what David Stanton, who's a friend of mine and who started the nonprofit in Yemen, the foundation, he started a fundraising drive on Kickstarter. I don't know if you've ever heard of the website, but it's a pretty cool website that allows you to post projects and people can donate at certain levels. And what's cool, too, is that they get rewards for donating, but it's a safe way to donate for people to any project that they wish. And so David has created a project that will, if it's successfully funded, it will have a great chance of creating a protected area in Yemen, which is one of the biggest steps that for the conservation of the Arabian leopard there.
That's great. Now, how would they find Kickstart? Is there a link on your webpage?
Yeah, there's a link on my website through my blog, or they can just type in kickstarter.com, and then the project's called Night Watch, camera trap thing for Arabian leopards. So if they just type in Night Watch, they would find it immediately.
That's great. So remember, yeah, Night Watch.
Yeah, Night Watch is what you got to type in. But the thing is, it is kind of a time crunch because there's always a limited number of time that you're allowed to have these projects on Kickstarter. So this Friday at midnight is when it's ending. So we only have 3 days left.
Oh, wow. With you saying that, I'm going to go ahead and edit this podcast and get it up sooner.
That would be great. And I mean, like I was saying, there's totally different levels of donating, but literally, and I know this is kind of an overset statement, but it's only because it's so true, and that's every dollar helps. If you just have a dollar, you know, it's going to do more than you can imagine.
Yes, it does. It all begins to add up.
Exactly.
So it's, if people are thinking that, hey, this is a great project, I'd like to, but I don't have that much, a dollar helps.
Yes, it's tremendously big, even a dollar.
Yep, I totally agree. So I am going to edit this podcast and get it up by tomorrow afternoon, Wednesday evening. I'll have it up there by Wednesday evening for you.
All right, that's great. Thanks, man.
You're welcome. Now, we could talk on and on about so many different things and projects that you've worked on and different environmental issues that you've seen and dealt with through your photography. But I'd like to save some of that for the next time I talk with you, because I would like to have you back on the show.
Yeah, I'd love to kind of do a follow-up on Yemen, and, you know, because this is my first big international assignment. I'm going to be going for 3 months, so I'll let you know how it went.
That'd be great, and I'd like to have you back after you get back and get settled and get back into the course of everything, because it's a wind-down time after you come back, and I'm sure that you're going to have a lot of beautiful pictures, and I do look forward to talking with you. But before we go, can you give us your webpage one more time?
Sure, that's just PumaPix, P-U-M-A, like the animal, and then P-I-X.com.
Excellent. Well, I thank you again for coming on the show. It's a pleasure having you, and I do look forward to having you back.
Thanks, Mel. I really appreciate being on the show and you taking the time.
I want to thank Sebastian for taking the time out of his busy schedule to come on Green News for You and talk about wildlife photography, especially endangered wildlife. I hope that you found this podcast very informative, and if you have, please consider being a sponsor or making a small donation to help run the site and this podcast. Thank you, and have a great Eco Week.